Thank you, Mary, and it's a real pleasure here today. In my mind, and this symposium is a long time coming. When biofortification first got some good momentum back in around 2000, and the focus was always on biofortification for content. One of our main emphasis at the Robert Holly Center and within USDA is, in addition to content, and almost more importantly, I think we need to pay attention to bioavailability. And bioavailability is really the key thing, and that's basically, I would encourage you to think about today is how we're delivering the nutrient. Are we delivering enough of the nutrient? Content, as Mary says, does not always breeding for content or managing for content does not always equate to delivering more bioavailable nutrient. And in biofortification, we're talking about the three main nutrients that are currently on our picture is iron, zinc, and provitamin A. And I think we have a great group of speakers here today to talk about these three nutrients and show us the progress that's been made not only in content, but more importantly, in how we're assessing bioavailability. So I'm going to focus on iron, and I'm going to focus on the techniques and the challenges. This is what most of my career at USDA has been dedicated to. And we need to keep in mind where is, for iron, which will be the focus of my talk, where is the primary site of absorption? Based on what we know, that seems to be in the upper small intestine. And most of the iron is absorbed there, although transporters are expressed for iron uptake throughout the intestine. Once we get down into the mid and lower small intestine, certainly in the colon, you have the microflora and the microbiome. And the microbes are very avid absorbers of iron. Now, this is a little bit about what we know about the site of iron absorption in man. A lot of this work was done a long time ago. That needs to be updated now. And a lot of the components of where iron is absorbed were never properly addressed. So how much iron can actually be absorbed in the lower intestine? Right now, we don't think very much at all. But a lot of those studies were done simply with isotopes and isotopic infusion and never looking at a whole food and how are we measuring any iron absorption in the lower small intestine, let alone the colon from staple food crops. So in measuring iron bioavailability, there's basically two approaches. You can have extrinsic labeling, which has always been for the past, I'd say, three decades for a lot of the human nutritionists working in this field, the more preferred method. And that's simply adding at about a level, usually 10% of the iron is added as an extrinsic isotope, a stable isotope, usually iron 58 or iron 57. Compared to intrinsically labeling, where you would grow a crop hydroponically, and basically then you're quantitating how much iron is going through the enterocyte into the bloodstream and distributing throughout the body. And that's basically the two approaches. Now, extrinsic labeling has been the method of choice for many nutritionists. It was reviewed back in 1983. One of the key quotes from that major review article was that this method cannot be considered proven with regards to all types of foods. The vast majority of the work occurred prior to 1983. Since then, there's been two studies, and these both came out of my lab, my research group, which have revisited this issue of extrinsic labeling of food iron. And what we found is that the primary assumption of studies using intrinsic labeling is that that isotopic label equilibrates fully with the intrinsic iron within the food. And for staple food crops, that's a big stretch and a big absorption. And what we found in revisiting this and testing it was just using simple iron solubility to demonstrate that it's not always consistent. And if you look here in the slide, you'll see these dashed lines that if these values, if we were getting equilibration, then these are values for iron solubility, which is the ratio of the extrinsic to the intrinsic iron, would be right on those dashed lines. And we have a list of a number of samples there, red lentils, white beans, black beans, some kidney beans, and even maize. And there's quite a bit of disagreement at all ranges that have been used historically for extrinsic labeling. So we can't trust it. We've known that for a long time. There's a certain camp of nutrition that has maintained using that for over 30 years. But I think it was something that I learned from my predecessors within USDARS, and certainly something we found. Now, how important is that number, that Morton's Very number? If you have an absorption study here, and you're giving a fractional iron absorption for different treatments of beans, then you're making calculations on the total amount of iron absorbed. And it calls into question whether this is actually an accurate number. And these are very important, because these numbers relate to efficacy studies that are even much more expensive, which involve much longer time frame. And the basis of the whole study design, the number of subjects, the amount of labeled of material you need to feed, is based on these fractional absorption numbers. If they're off, that whole study is also called into question. Intrinsic labeling also has its drawbacks. Although you can be more confident that you've got the intrinsic label into the crop, they tend to grow differently. So you can here see some nice lentil fields up in Saskatchewan. Same variety grown in the field, grown hydroponically. Looks much different. Look at the differences in the root structure. Aside from being more expensive and limiting in amount of materials, you have those issues as well. Moving on to in vitro measurement of iron bioavailability, it would really be great if all we had to look at was solubility and dialyzability. But part of the reason I was given a job with USDARS was to overcome this aspect, where we found that solubility did not equate always to bioavailability. It's not a reliable indicator. And this is one example in the literature. A study came out of our group where we looked at phytic acid and tannic acid. And you can see here we have pretty high solubility for some iron, but the bioavailability differences can be much different. Here's with tannic acid creating a lot of ferrous iron, which is more available for absorption. However, the bioavailability is extremely low in that sample. So, where have we gone from that over the years? And I wish I could spend an hour on this subject, but we only have about 15 minutes. What's evolved and evolved out of our research group is the combination of the in vitro modeling and combining CaCO2 cells. The human intestinal cell line is a living component and a way to measure iron absorption, iron uptake, and simulating digestion, and that's the CaCO2 cell bioassay. And then another model that's found a really nice role in iron nutrition bioavailability studies now is the poultry model. And this is a review article published by our group recently. And this combination, it cost effectively negates the issues that are associated with the traditional methods involving intrinsic and extrinsic labeling, and does so in a cost-effective manner. More importantly, with this model, these can be used to determine mechanisms of iron bioavailability. It can be used to monitor the nutritional quality of staple food crops once they're released and out into the food supply. And you can basically evaluate meals, diets, meal plans, menus, virtually anything you can feed the humans, we can feed to our in vitro digestion model and our poultry model. So how has some of this been applied? I wanted to show a few examples here. Well, recently I got some different maize samples that were given to me by one of our maize breeders at Cornell. And, you know, these are about 100 kernels in a packet. And I sat down at my desk one day and started cutting out the germ section of each seed. And then that was going to be a big task. So I got a couple of people in my lab group to chip in with that. But basically what we did was testing the idea of where is the iron in the maize kernel. We didn't have any good knowledge of that. And while we're testing where it is, let's just see if it's available for absorption. So this is a study with six different varieties of maize. And if you look at some of these pictures, you can see that some of the differences are quite obvious. In the CML, you see there's very little of the flowery endosperm compared to a B73 or this M37W. And these are the things that got my interest. When I looked at the whole kernel and the bioavailability from the whole kernel, I found that it was much less often than simply when we took the germ fraction away. When we looked at the bioavailability in the germ fraction, which the concentration can be quite high, this is in micrograms per gram, the amount of iron in the germ fractions, you see that the iron is not bioavailable from the germ fraction of maize. And really, maybe what we should be doing, if we're doing QTL mapping for iron bioavailability and delivering more iron in maize, is measuring the amount of iron that's in the endosperm. That's our phenotype that we want to be using. This is a commonality we also see with wheat and to some extent with rice. I'm going to skip this slide in the sake of time. Now, moving on with that same idea to reinforce it, we got some fractions from the center at Iowa State in the commercially milling fractions, and the same basic idea is held true. The germ fraction is not as clean cut in those as how we're dissecting them by hand, but we're seeing the same basic effect, that even with relatively high concentration, the bioavailability is quite low. What was interesting was in that gluten fraction, a lot of iron was in the gluten fraction, and it gave us some of our highest bioavailability rankings. Now, what's really important when you look at this is this is maize, and the ferritin formation approach that we use, if we're taking beans, oftentimes a bean sample, particularly the ones that have been released in Africa as the high iron beans as studied in Rwanda, they're in this range right here. Those are the ones that have been tested for iron biofortified foods. So what does that say? That says we have the potential probably from this study to deliver more iron in maize by getting more of the iron into that endosperm fraction. If you just go down to the supermarket, and it's interesting, you can buy some fortified products, and here's a degerminated product that was fortified with iron at 44 parts per million. Once again, see how high it's ranking relative to a whole cornmeal or a fortified whole cornmeal. And here was just a whole grain wheat flour and then a white flour, an 80% extraction. And you can see the content is relatively low there. I'm not going to speak a lot about what we're doing with our bean panels. That's for Karen Sihi to discuss later in one of the next couple talks coming up. But I wanted to show you some additional capabilities that we are doing with this yellow bean panel that we're working with here. And we tried to color coordinate the bars to the yellow beans in this market class that we're working on here. And as reference controls, you see we have the JB178 and the PR0 varieties down here in the lower right corner. Well, if you pay attention to the panels on the right, this is the iron concentration in those samples. And notice how the red varieties are some of the highest. That's something we've seen quite consistently over the years, in that the colored bean varieties with the high levels of polyphenolics in the seed coat will be the highest in iron content. You go to the panels on this side, on your right, the effect when you look at the amount of iron that's deliverable and absorbable, then we're seeing it change. Okay? And that these high iron lines are giving a fraction of the bioavailability compared to white versus some of our yellow bean varieties. Now, this is very important because what I didn't mention earlier is that this screening approach and these methodologies that we've developed and tested over the years and compared to human studies have been matching the human studies perfectly. We are thoroughly validated, and I encourage you to read that review article that Dr. Taco and I co-authored some time ago. So now the results that come out of the in vitro methodology, the combination of the in vitro digestion in the KCO2 cells and coupled with the poultry model, can be seen much differently and carry much more weight in this area of nutrition. And that's been that's been significant progress since we've started along this line, where we didn't have as much validity and validation testing back in 1998 when we came up with this approach. But now over the past 20 years, it's been tested time and time again, and is predicting the human studies quite well. On that end, if we evaluate what's in our supermarket, and we're in the process right now of looking at what's been in the marketplace through many locations in Africa as well, but the high iron Rwanda beans that are released by Harvest Plus for biofortification routinely tested in our laboratory in that range. And if I just go down to the supermarket and grab every bag of Goya beans or different market classes, this is what I'm finding in our supermarket. So what this is saying is that we have products already out there in the food supply for iron, at least from beans, that are going to deliver much more absorbable iron than what has been cited based on breeding solely for content by Harvest Plus. This was a paper that I thought was very interesting. I wanted to include it in the talk because it helps explain a lot of what I think we've seen with beans over the past 20 years in terms of bioavailability. And it kind of went under the radar for a while. And a couple of these people even visited my lab and never even told me about this work. But if you look down here in the bottom corners, you'll see images of the cotyledon cells. And that blue in there is the staining of where iron is in cotyledon cells. And in the cotyledon, you actually have about 70 to 80% of the iron is in the cotyledon. Another 1 to 2% is in the embryo, and then maybe anywhere from 20% to 5% is in the seed coat. Well, when we digest, when we consume beans, okay, our intestinal tract does not have the capability to break down that cotyledon cell wall. And cooking does not break it down. There's certain mechanical processing that'll break it down. You know, grinding the bean flour while it's raw versus cooked will break up the cell walls and release that. But this is a new factor that we've discovered in the recent years, in that the cotyledon cell wall and that intracellular matrix is actually a barrier for iron bioavailability. In some varieties, when you break the cell wall up, you get an enhancement. It's mild, it's small, and in some you have no change. But this was, and it makes a lot of sense, and it correlates with a study that also came under the radar back in 1998 that was done in humans, where they had white beans, and they showed that only when you get down into the lower part of the small intestine do you start seeing those cotyledon cells break up, and that's because of the presence of the microbes and the bacteria. So once again, that's what's interesting about this is that we're talking about a crop that the major sink of iron in that crop is getting past the major site of absorption in humans for iron. So if we're going to biofortify beans, we got to take that factor into account. Here's another application of our in vitro model, and this was doing in tandem with the study. It was also mentioned as in that review article, and we have our own publication on this work. But when you're looking at iron bioavailability in a staple food crop, you must address it in the context of the diet and the food supply that it's in, because these are factors that can certainly affect the iron bioavailability. And you know, let me back up to that slide. In Rwanda, this was done in a cafeteria, so this was the only efficacy study that's been done to date on beans. And here you can see what a typical plate looked like for the women consuming in Rwanda. Now, we went further with our modeling, and we were able to look at all the different components that were in that diet plan, looking for evidence of where there was soil contamination by aluminum and titanium levels, and based on dry weight alone, we can give a ranking of bioavailability. We showed some nice effects here that combining beans with potato makes the iron more available than combining beans with rice. That's interesting. That's why you need to look at bioavailability and delivering iron in the context of the food supply. In summary, like I said, it's nice to have this session here today. We got a great list of speakers coming up, but I think we need to breed for improved iron bioavailability with paying attention to maintaining and monitoring iron content. And although, you know, to date all the work has been done in breeding for iron concentration, there is some evidence there of proof of concept, a study in the Philippines with rice, a study with the Rwanda beans, and a study with pearl millet. These effects are relatively small, and I think we can do a lot more and deliver a lot more of nutritious foods by developing our food systems for iron. We need to address the mechanisms of iron bioavailability, the cotyledon cell wall. Karen's going to talk a little bit later about breeding for enhanced cooking time, and be happy to talk with anybody later about how that will deliver more nutrition. For maize and wheat, we have this this observation of increasing the iron concentration in the endosperm. And we need to use these tools properly as we're developing crops with QTL mapping and be able to monitor and any established lines. And most importantly, always look at these in the context of the diet. I think I made my time. Just on that. I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues and the research support staff at my location. Thank you all, and enjoy the day.